So my name is Manuel, and I'm working for Metlo Toledo, actually. And I'm doing there a lot of concept work for our Debian-based embedded Linux distribution that is used across some of our divisions inside the company, so mainly the library and industrial division. And they are building products on top of this embedded Linux distribution. So our goal is to just harmonize stuff, like having a single kernel source tree for all our products, doing security maintenance for all of the products in a common platform, also provide techniques for deploying updates and so on. And beside that, I'm also working a bit on our GitLab CI pipelines, and I'm also a member of our open source focus group at Metlo Toledo, where we sync across our divisions that are around the world about how we want to work with open source and establish some kind of open source strategies and stuff like this. Privately, I'm also a Debian user and contributor since a long time. I started to become a package maintainer for packages we use inside the company, and also some of them I use privately. I also start using Debian on my mobile phone now, and it's quite a funny experience. I started using Linux on mobile phones with OpenMoku. Maybe some of you have heard of it, and it was just pain, and nowadays you can use it actually to do most of your daily work. I'm a minor contributor to the Linux kernel, to U-Boot and other projects. And yeah. Now about my talk, I will just show you the motivation, why we want to do this. And then something about the system architecture. Then we will have a big part about the firmware that we need to do to achieve booting like a PC. Then a shorter section about the operating system things. We have heard about this already a lot in the previous talks today and yesterday. And then I will give some conclusion. So on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, you see a product that is actually running Debian Linux already. And now we get a few more requirements on those things. So we want to protect our intellectual property that is somehow in the software on the product. We want to allow only trusted devices to access certain cloud services. We want to install trusted software upgrades only, and the big topic is we want to do just upgrades, don't allow downgrades here, because otherwise some people can go back to a version that is vulnerable. And also we want to give the opportunity to allow users to exchange or add software, but then the device needs to be unlocked, so we need to detect this case for things. These are requirements that hit our platform. That does not mean that all products need all of those requirements, so they are more like opt-in here. And then we thought about how could we implement this. And we are on a classic ARM64 system-on-chip-based thingy. Who is familiar with ARM64, but just to... okay, great. So who knows about Trust Zone? Okay, great. Just to get a bit an idea of the audience, so where we need to go more in detail and so on. So what we thought about is, hey, in the PC world, we have a lot of security stuff already available. And what do they use? So actually, they don't need to protect intellectual property typically, but they need to protect users' private data. And we all use Lux since a long time for that, so probably we could also use Lux to protect our intellectual property on the device. So if someone unsoldiers the eMMC, that the data is not just visible for him. To allow only trusted devices to access cloud services, what's the difference between a device and the user is some kind of how the identity is managed, and we all use OpenSSL and stuff like this for this, so probably we can also use this, and we've seen this, that a TPM2 can be used as a backend for storing the secrets, and then they can also be sealed to those PCR values. Leonard talked about this already yesterday already in the talk. And then we can say, yeah, just if we have booted a fully trusted device, we can unlock the secrets that are needed or the certificates that are needed to authenticate at a cloud service. To install trusted software upgrades, there is systemd sysupdate along with DMVerity and stuff like that available. And to allow users to exchange or add own software on a PC, you can just disable secure boot in the BIOS and or in EFI, and then you can install whatever you want. And we thought this might match very well our requirements, so what do we need to do to use this in our embedded system? So currently we use a classic embedded bootloader called Das U-Boot and the distro boot feature that is available in many distributions. So you have some Xlinux conf file where you have all the menu entries, and then the bootloader just selects one. It's more or less looks a bit like grub. What's the difference to a PC? A PC typically boots with UEFI and has a TPM2. So it's a different interface, and they have some kind of additional hardware here. So we don't have a TPM2 actually in our hardware, so we need to find a solution for that. And then we started thinking about the system architecture, so could we add a TPM2 as a piece of hardware? But we found out.
Your slide are not changing on the.
Oh, thanks. So just the slides did only change on my display for whatever reason. So I've talked about this. Now we are here. So the system architecture. We need to implement some things, and we found out. Yeah, everything is already available. So UEFI support can be just enabled in U-Boot. There is a TPM2 implementation, a reference implementation from Microsoft with some bindings for Opti, which is running in the trust zone. And also the platform support we need for our IMX8MM system on chip is already available of everything. So hey, it's just an integration task, seems to be easy. Then we researched a bit more about it and found out that there is some specification from ARM that is called system ready with different profiles. And this specification in the end describes exactly that. Hey, boot via EFI with TPM support, and then you can boot any distribution on an ARM platform. We also found that Linaro is working heavily on this topic at the moment. They call it Linaro Trusted Substrate. And they are also building exactly what we want to have. And it's a lot of documentation available here. So also something, if you're interested in that, it's a very good entry point to get more and very detailed information. Okay, I need to switch the slides twice, that's interesting. So the system architecture now looks like this. On the bottom side we have a hardware, and this is always system on chip and very vendor specific. If you have a chip from Freescale, it will look different as if you have one from TI and so on. But in the end, it's more or less the same. So you have some ROM code that is looking at some position.
No.
Oh. Thanks. So you have some ROM code that is looking at some positions like on the EMMC or SD card, for a code that can be executed first, and you are in a very limited situation then, so you have no DRAM available, just like a few kilobytes of SDRAM and so on. And you have also some fuses in this system on chip, so-called E-fuses, so you can burn them just once. It's something that is very scary for a software engineer. You do it once and then it's really burned into the hardware and you can never ever change it. But this is needed for the security, so you burn into these E-fuses, for example, the hashes of the keys you use to authenticate the very first boot stage. So this is something you really, really need to do. And then you are in this very first boot stage. You have burned the E-fuses so that you are not anymore allowed to use, for example, a JTAGger to do hardware debugging on the system, that you only allow to boot from the source you really want to boot, because of most of those chips have options to sideload boot code from, for example, a serial USB protocol, and this is also something an attacker could use. So this is very low-level stuff you need to think about, and it's always hardware-specific. And then you have this first-stage bootloader, and there you're happy, you can initialize your DRAM, you have more memory, and so on. And then from there you start the trusted firmware ARM, which is actually a hypervisor, because the ARM64 architecture provides us two modes of operation. We have a secure world where security-related stuff is running, and we have the so-called normal world where Linux and the bootloader and stuff like this is running. And this hypervisor actually is able to map some resources into one or the other zone, and then it's not visible for the other zone or visible for both zones. You can configure that. And so we can, for example, map some things we only want to have available in this TPM, highly secure area, into our trust zone and exclude them from Linux and have some kind of partitioning here. After this hypervisor is set up, we can load the so-called OPTI operating system, which is actually a really, really small operating system where you can implement secure applications, trusted applications, so-called TAs, that can be dynamically loaded also during runtime. But what we actually did, we implemented integrated the FTPM code that is currently a reference implementation from Microsoft Research and Development into this OPTI trust zone thing. And we really compiled it in because we wanted to have it available really early. So we could also load it after the system is booted from Linux, but we wanted to have it really early available so that we can do already PCR measurements in the bootloader, for example. And then we load into the normal world the U-boot bootloader with activated EFI interface, with compiled in device tree, for example. So we really host our device-specific hardware information inside the bootloader binary, and it passes it via EFI memory map to the operating system. You could also do this with this unified kernel images. There you could also attach the device tree with the hardware-specific information. But we decided we want all hardware-specific stuff inside this firmware area, because this is also something PCs do. You don't have any special kernel or special UKI for your laptop. You can just pass a UKI from you to your colleague and it will boot. And we wanted to have something like the same. And therefore, we decided to have the device tree also in the bootloader. And then, yes, we have this ARM system ready interface here, which is basically UAV and TPM available. And our U-boot bootloader is now able to execute signed EFI binaries, verify the signature, And to verify the signature, the TPM needs some memory to store the keys and the states and all the stuff. And let's go a slide back, because we did not talk about this blue box called the eMMC in the top. So the TPM implementation in Opti needs some non-volatile memory. And we have already non-volatile memory in our system. It's the eMMC. It's like an SD card soldered on your board with some extra options. And one of these extra options is the so-called RPMB block, which is some kind of secure storage inside your eMMC. So you need a key to write to this memory. And we use this to store our AFI variables. And we use it also to store our states and keys and stuff inside the FTPM. And those AFI keys here can be used to authenticate our next stage, the systemd boot stage, which is the systemd bootloader, and selects the next EFI binary, the so-called unified kernel image. And in our case, it contains the Linux kernel, the initrd, and the kernel command line, and the verity user hash of our verified user partition in the user land. And so this one is checked by AFI, and there we have the verity user hash for our verity partition, which contains the data that shall be not modifiable. And then we can also have some kind of looks partition inside the user space, which is also protected by a key that can be stored in the TPM, which will be in the RPMB in the end. So I have a bit more detailed look into those firmware components now. So the OptiOS is the one that is running in this secure world, splitted by this trusted firmware ARM hypervisor from the Linux world. And there we have this FTPM sample firmware implementation. And the nice thing about this FTPM implementation is that it is already well integrated in the whole ecosystem. So there is a driver available in U-boot and in mainline Linux. So if you just have this FTPM trusted application in your Opti, you would automatically detect, hey, I have a TPM, and also the Linux kernel say, yeah, cool, there is a TPM. So from a user perspective, there is no difference than you have a soldier TPM on your device. There is also, at the moment, this FTPM code is some kind of sample application reference code from Microsoft. And Jens Wicklander from Linaro, who is also the maintainer of OptiOS, has just opened a pull request for merging this FTPM trusted application into the official OptiOS repository that it can be better maintained. And this is really great. So Jens Wicklander is doing great work here in this area at the moment. So for example, also for this non-volatile storage, you need the RPMB block of the eMMC I've just described. And that's a bit of tricky because I've told you there is this trusted firmware ARM, which is a hypervisor where you need to decide if a resource is in the secure world or in the non-secure world. So the eMMC, where do you want to put it? I need it in the secure world for the RPMB, but I need it also in the non-secure world because I need a file system for my Linux. So, yeah. The decision the architects did was to map it into the non-secure world and to have some kind of IPC between the secure and non-secure world. They can do requests like read an RPMB block and stuff like this. So this means you need in your non-secure world some kind of help application or supplicant that answers those requests from the secure world to read out these RPMB blocks and send data back into the secure world. So U-boot includes already some handling code who is exactly doing this. In Linux, we have an application called tzipglycan that actually runs in user space that can be used for this. So this, there you just configure which MMZ device you want to use, and then it handles those opti requests in user space and reads out the RPMB. A lot of context switches between kernel space and user space happen, and then the data is sent again back via shared memory into the trusted world. And also Jens Wicklander from Linaro now worked on the RPMB zip system inside the Linux kernel. And this is merged now with 6.11.
Yeah.
And so the kernel is already able to handle these opti requests for reading the RPMB block and can send it directly back. So you don't have those additional switches into user space anymore. So now let's talk a bit more about this RPMB thing. This RPMB thing works like it's a replay protected memory block, I guess it is called. So you need a symmetric key to write to this device. And a symmetric key is always some kind of nasty because you need to have the same key in your application and burned into the EMMC. So what you actually do is at some point of time where you're in your bring up phase of your board, you write the symmetric key into your EMMC. This is a write once thing again. So if you miss this once with a wrong key and you want to change the key, you have no option. You need to throw away the chip and buy a new one. And another nasty thing about the symmetric key is I don't want to have this compiled into my software. Because if I compile it into my software, some ugly hacker can come, decompile my software, analyze it, and somehow he will find the key, actually. It's just a question of time. So what is typically done is you think about some device-specific thing that can be used to derive the RPMB key from. And luckily in the IMX world, we have some kind of unique device ID, and we can configure the trusted firmware ARM that this one is only readable in the trust zone. So if someone has access to the Linux system, he's not able to read this ID. So we can use this one to derive our key from it. And this is what we actually do on first boot. During production, we have a special version of Opti that is deriving this key from the unique device ID and then writing it into the EMMC block. And then in the real world, we don't need to write it anymore. So we have a different firmware then that is flashed into the device that is just deriving this key when it is needed from the unique device ID and using it. And So the next component is U-boot. And U-boot is really fine because AFI support is mainline. Secure-boot support is mainline. The AFI variables can be stored in Opti. Opti stores them somewhere in the RPMB, depending on your configuration of Opti. And you need to just use from the EDK to some component called standalone MM that is linked to Opti. And this is really good documented in the U-boot documentation. So this was really straightforward to do. And we had no big issues here. Also, AFI capsule upgrade support is mainline in U-boot, so this can be used to upgrade U-boot itself again. We did not have the time to test this so far, but we've seen people in the field using this, so we expect that this will also work. So now we can luckily use an operating system, so we like on a PC, and we can use the TPM to do PCR measurements. We can do them really early in the initrd because we have the TPM compiled into our firmware. We have the kernel patched, so it includes this RPMB interface, and we don't need any special additional user space components for that. Otherwise, we would need the tsupplycand and the initrd already. We don't need that, so that's great. We can use systemd PCR lock to lock down or see the status of our PCR registers. We can deploy Lux keys now with system decrypt and troll and bind it, for example, to the PCR7 register, which is storing the information if secure boot is enabled and which keys are configured. So if someone is changing the EV keys or disabled secure boot, then the Lux device will no longer be opened, which is really cool. We can manage the credentials used by our services, like passwords and so on, with systemd creds, and also bind this to the PCR values. We use MKOZ to build our OS images now, and this is also really great because it does the complete signature thing and key management for us, so you can just say MKOZ gen key, and you get all the keys you need, and then you have a signed UKI image and everything is configured. It's really, really cool. We are able to apply AB style OS upgrades that are also generated by MKOZ and detected by systemd boot, and there's support from boot control for this, which is really, really cool. And we can also create and resize partitions with systemd repart, so we can use the whole really cool systemd ecosystem now on this device. So let's review our requirements. So protecting our IP is possible now with the Lux volumes backed by a TPM. Protect certificates is also possible. We can store them in TPM, seal them to PCR values. We can deploy operating system upgrades. On the systemd sysupdate thing is just something missing for us. So we don't have the option to verify the signature or for an upgrade. So we often have all the devices that are just used offline, so the update mechanism is like plugging, having the update file on a USB stick and plugging it into the device. And currently, systemd sysupdate does not provide any option to verify some signature of this update file and only apply authenticated updates. But I guess this is something that is not too hard to implement. Then we can boot the latest OS. It's just something around boot counting and fallback that is missing. I will talk about this later. Then we can boot verified operating systems only, and that can be done if it just enables secure boot in AFI. We can unlock devices by deploying new AFI keys. And we realized, hey, there are even more benefits now because the same OS image boots on many devices now. Before we had some things like, is the root file system stored on MMC-BLK0 or MMC-BLK1? And this was some device-specific detail that needed to be somewhere in the root file system. And with these auto-discoverable disk images, we don't have this anymore. That's great. And also we realized, hey, we can install any Linux distribution now on our devices as long as we as the needed kernel drivers available, because the device tree is part of our firmware and passed to the kernel. And yeah, so that's quite cool. And we can have a look at two things now. One is the systemd sysupgrade, which was mainly done by Burak sitting in the first row here.
Is it already running?
I don't know. Yeah. So you will see the versions that are available. Then we check for new versions. There is none. Then we look at the USB stick that is plugged into the device. And actually, at the moment, we need to rename the file so that they match the pattern. that is configured for systemd sysupgrade, because MKOZ generates them with a dot and sysupgrade expects them with an underscore. But if you manage this, then the update will be just applied. I increased the speed a bit on the presentation, and then you can reboot and you will boot into the new system and you can run boot control and other system the sysupdate list, and you will see that you are in the new system. And the second demo I've prepared is running the Fedora installer, so now we are in the bootloader. And we say just boot our initialize our TPM and boot our AFI system, and then I just DD'd the Fedora installer, downloaded from fedora.org. Thanks. From fedora.org, and it just started booting. And we see then at some point in time the Anaconda installer running. So now we plan to do this to have a Debian-based system, but it's now also very cool that we can just verify some things with other distributions, and it's a really nice benefit we just get out of the box now. So I guess we don't need to watch this till the end. So I skip to the next slide. So what are the open topics and next steps? Think about the sysupdate thing. Either we can implement the boot count logic required by systemd boot in Rauk, or we need to implement some file-based signature verification in systemd sysupdate. There are many reasons to use Rauk in our site, so probably we go with the later. Because it supports more of the embedded use cases we need. Then we need to implement fatmove in UBoot, because actually boot counting is done by renaming the UKIs. So you have something like booted this once out of three tries, which is done by the file name, and you need to rename this file if it tries boot, and if it's booted, then it's renamed back by some systemd service. But fatmove is not implemented in UBoot, so this does not work, but shall be easy to fix, I guess. And then we try to learn more from those enterprise Linux admins, because now we have the question, how do we provision new systems? So how do we get the Lux recovery key back into our production system and stuff like this? How do we deploy update revokes, keys and certificates? What tools and infrastructure is available there that we can reuse in our embedded world? Then we need to think how to maintain the firmware components, because at the moment we have UBoot, we have FTPM, we have Opti, they all have Git submodules like Wolf SSL and stuff like this, so it's like 10 to 20 Git repositories we need to clone to build this firmware, and we need to have some SBOM about security tracking, find out when we need to build new versions. There might be the way to go with the trusted firmware substrate thing Linaro is doing. They're using Bitbake for building the firmware, which might be an interesting approach here, because I guess it would solve all those issues. We can try AFI Capsule upgrade, and then we also found out, hey, there's AFI Frame Buffer for displaying a bootloader go in the early boot stage, and it can continue by playmoff without flickering like on a PC, which is really cool, but we need to try it out. And we also did some contributions during our work, so the RPMB kernel patches done by Jens Wicklander, we tested them really early and we found out a really ugly thing. The RPMB data needs to be actually be block aligned. Page aligned, sorry, typo on the slides, needs to be page aligned, because it's directly passed into the SDHCAI controller, which is doing DMA, and DMA always expects page aligned data, and it acts directly on the Opti shared memory, and this was in this case not page aligned, so some requests worked, others not, and it was a bit of struggling to find that out, but then Jens could just ensure that the buffer is always page aligned, and now it works also on our device. Then Burak did some systemd sysupdate patch, which just warns the user about some mismatch if a match pattern does not match source and Then we did some MKOZ bug reports, and of course we have some backlog. And time is now nearly over, so conclusion is it works. It is some work, and And if you want to try it by your own, you can rebuild the demos. You just need to have the hardware. The code is on GitHub. Try it, contact me if you have any issues with it, play around with it, it's really cool stuff. I can just recommend it, and at the very end, thanks to All Systems Go for the invitation, for all those communities and projects that do great work here, and for my company that I'm visible to here, and yeah, that's it. I'm open for questions now.
Thank you very much. We have 4 minutes for questions.
You said that it is the kernel that accesses the RPMB. So the kernel knows the symmetric key. Am I right? So it can be exfiltrated.
The symmetric key is known by Opti, actually. So Opti does the request to write to the RPMB, and it reads the boot counter and has the symmetric key, does the encryption, and send the encrypted data to the kernel.
Oh, so okay, because okay,
or the well-signed data that is accepted by the RPMB that way
okay.
around.
One more thing. Do you run MKOC for building the ARM64 images on x86?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe I'll have some more questions.
Yeah,
later.
You can have a look at the code at GitHub. There's the MKOC config for all of this.
Do you think it's also gonna work for pre-installed images?
For what kind of images?
Pre-installed images, like you use Fedora installer, right?
Yeah.
And if I already have a whole image like .emg pre-installed, everything's already there,
yeah.
And I just write on the AMC, it's going to work?
Yeah, that will also work. That is exactly our use case here. So it also works with some kind of Ubuntu images that you just download there. Those generic Arch64 images will also boot here.
Any other question?
Not a super serious question, but what can I do to run Doom on your scales?
It is possible, actually. I also played Super Tux card and stuff like this. We need to test also the 3D stuff, you know.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.